Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Back to another episode this week in preparation for the new Kong film that is coming out, Kong Skull Island, in about a week or so. I decided to take a look at the three previous King Kong origin films: King Kong 1933, King Kong 1976, and King Kong 2005. Mash them all together and put them in a pie. Now, put them together and see what works versus what doesn't work and compare the films and contrast the films in a lot of different ways in preparation for this new film, which I have to say, from the trailers and what I've seen, it looks fantastic. Set in the 70s with kind of a Apocalypse Now vibe going for it. So very excited about Skull Island. So anyway, let's jump in to some background on the Kong franchise. The main guy responsible for coming up with Kong, his name is Marion C. Cooper. And his fascination with gorillas began with his boyhood reading of a guy by the name of Paul Duchailu's book, Explorations and Adventures in Equatorial Africa, which was written in 1861. And in 1929, he was filming The Four Feathers in Africa and was studying on, you know, I guess on the side, studying this tribe of baboons while he was there. After reading another book, a book called The Dragon Lizards by W. Douglas Burden, he fashioned a scenario depicting African gorillas battling Komodo dragons. Kong versus Godzilla, anyone? He then narrowed the dramatis persona to one ferocious lizard battling gorilla rather than a group, and included a lone woman on expedition to appease those critics who belabored him for neglecting romance in his films. A remote island would be the setting, and the gorilla would be dealt a spectacular death in New York City. So Cooper took this concept to Paramount Studios in the first years of the Great Depression, but executives shied away from a project that sent film crews on costly shoots to Africa and Komodo. In 1931, David O. Selznick brought Cooper to RKO Pictures as his executive assistant, and to sweeten the deal, promised him he could make his own films. Cooper began immediately developing The Most Dangerous Game, a story about a big game hunter, and hired his friend and former film partner Ernest Shosdack to direct. A huge jungle stage set was built with Robert Armstrong and Fay Wray as the stars. Once the film was underway, Cooper turned his attention to the studio's big-budget, out-of-control fantasy film called Creation, a story about a group of travelers shipwrecked on an island of dinosaurs. The film employed special effects wizard Willis O'Brien. When Cooper screened O'Brien's stop-motion Creation footage, he was unimpressed, but realized he could economically make the gorilla picture by scrapping the Komodo dragons and costly location shoots for O'Brien's animated dinosaurs, and the studio's existing jungle set. And it was at this time Cooper probably cast his gorilla as a giant named Kong and planned to have him die at the Empire State Building. The RKO board was very wary about the project, but gave its approval after Cooper organized a presentation with Ray Armstrong and Cabo and O'Brien's model dinosaurs. In his executive capacity, Cooper ordered the Creation project shelved and put its crew to work on Kong. So, Kong released in 1933, very financially successful, so much so that 9 months later was the sequel Son of Kong, later in 1933, and that film, they go back to the island, and pretty much the entire film takes place on Skull Island with, you know, young Kong, Kong's offspring, and then the franchise fell dormant until 1962, when they did a King Kong versus Godzilla film, and I think this was done by, you know, Japanese companies who are doing man-in-the-suit Godzillas at the moment. And in this film, Kong is discovered by a Japanese corporation, brought to Japan, where he fights against a newly defrosted Godzilla. And the first round, Godzilla burns him with his atomic breath. They put Kong to sleep, bring him to Mount Fuji to fight Godzilla. Kong uses electricity to temporarily juice himself up a kaiju band, if you will. They both fall into the sea and only Kong emerges. So it's left open as to, you know, the Godzilla's fate, of course. In 1967, 5 years later, a film called King Kong Escapes. And it was basically, I think the whole thing was basically about Kong versus a mechanical Kong. So 67 then to 76, Universal had originally planned to make a more faithful remake of Kong, the original 1933 Kong, to be entitled The Legend of King Kong, which was going to be a period piece set in the 30s, which, you know, foreshadows Jackson's movie. However, they backed out when this modern remake was announced. And also, you know, the film they were talking about would have been released in Censoround, which, if you older listeners out there may remember, the film Earthquake was released in Censoround. It was supposed to be, you know, all these devices planted throughout the theater that made you feel rumbles and shakes and, you know, anything that the characters were feeling, supposedly you were feeling. So this script was written by a gentleman named Lorenzo Semple Jr., who later recalled, quote, "We made a very deliberate attempt not to be anything like the original movie in tone or mood. Dino," and he's talking about Dino De Laurentiis here, who was, you know, the king of the epic film, wanted it to be light and amusing rather than pretentious. "I don't think the original was meant to be mythic. The original King Kong is extremely crude. I don't mean it's not wonderful. It was remarkable for its time, but it was a very small backlot picture. We thought times had changed so much that audiences were more sophisticated. Dino felt we could have more fun with it. We hope to do sensational things with advanced effects on a big screen," end quote. Lorenzo Semple Jr. says Universal wanted to make their own version of the story, from a script by a gentleman named Bo Goldman to be directed by a guy named Joseph Sargent and starring Peter Falk as Carl Denham, which did not happen. During some of the casting, they were looking at Meryl Streep. She was considered but deemed too unattractive by Dino De Laurentiis, which is just too funny for words. Finally, the role went to newcomer Jessica Lange, which is her first feature film. Kong was released in 76, made enough money to greenlight a sequel 10 years later that became King Kong Lives, 1986. And in that film, Kong is in a coma, and he's given an artificial heart. They find another Kong, who I guess is called Lady Kong. He gets a blood transfusion for her. I think Kong dies at the end of this one, and, you know, Mrs. Kong gives birth to a son, which kind of ends, you know. After this, they didn't do much more, so I don't think King Kong Lives did very well. Then in 2005, we had the release of Peter Jackson's King Kong. Now, Jackson was 9 years old when he first saw the original film, was in tears in front of the TV when Kong slipped off the Empire State Building. At age 12, he attempted to recreate the film using his parents' Super 8 millimeter film camera and a model of Kong made of wire and rubber with his mother's fur coat for the hair. King Kong eventually became his favorite film and was the primary inspiration for his decision to become a filmmaker as a teenager. He read books about the making of Kong and collected memorabilia, as well as articles from famous monsters of filmland. Jackson paid tribute to the 1933 film by including Skull Island as the origin of the zombie plague in his 1992 film, Brain Dead. So during the filming of Jackson's 1996 film, The Frighteners, Universal Pictures was impressed with the dailies enough and the early visual effects footage, and they wanted to work with him. So in 1995, they offered him the chance to direct a remake of this 1954 Creature from the Black Lagoon, and he turned down the offer. But Universal became aware of Jackson's obsession with Kong and subsequently offered him the opportunity to direct that remake. The studio did not have to worry about lawsuits concerning film rights from RKO Pictures because the King Kong character is held in the public domain, which is something I did not know. Jackson initially turned down the King Kong offer, but he quickly became disturbed by the fact that someone else would take it over and make it into a terrible film that would haunt him, so he eventually said yes to it. At the same time, Jackson was working with Harvey Weinstein and Miramax to purchase the film rights for The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, while 20th Century Fox was trying to hire him for the 2001 remake of Planet of the Apes. Jackson turned down Apes because Weinstein was taking longer than expected to buy Rings, so Jackson decided to move forward on King Kong. Weinstein was furious, and as a result, Jackson proposed a deal between Universal and Miramax that the two studios would equally finance King Kong with Jackson's production company, Wingnut Films. Universal would receive distribution rights in the States, while Miramax would cover foreign territories. Jackson was also warranted the right of final cut privilege, a percentage of the gross profits, as well as artistic control. Universal allowed all filming and visual effects to be handled entirely in New Zealand. And the deal was settled in April 1996, and they started work on the script. So they approved of the script with Robert Zemeckis as executive producer, and pre-production for the film started. And the plan was to begin filming sometime in 97 for a summer 98 release. So even then, Jackson was employing Weta Digital and Weta Workshop, and they began work on the visual effects, specifically the task of building a CGI version of 1933 in New York. Jackson and Fran Walsh progressed on the second draft of the script. Sets were being designed. Location scouting was happening. In 96, Jackson flew to a production of the film Titanic in Mexico to discuss the part of Andara with Kate Winslet, with whom he previously worked with on Heavenly Creatures. Minnie Driver was also reportedly considered. Jackson's choice for Jack Driscoll and Carl Denham included George Clooney and Robert De Niro. However, development for Kong was stalled in 97 when Universal became concerned over the upcoming release of the 1998 film Godzilla, which was directed by Roland Emmerich, as well as other ape-related remakes with the 1998 film Mighty Joe Young and the 2001 film Planet of the Apes. Universal abandoned Kong in February 97 after Weta Workshop and Weta Digital had already designed 6 months' worth of pre-production. Jackson then decided to start work on Rings. So, of course, with the financial and ridiculous success of the Rings trilogy, Universal approached Jackson again in 2003 during the post-production of Return of the King, trying to find out what he was going to do next. And so they came together to decide to do Kong, you know, after about 10 years, I think, something like that, 8 years, something like that. So right away, he brought in his co-writers, Fran Walsh and Philippa Boyens, who wrote Rings with him. And in late October 2003, started writing a new script. That is the background and the franchise to date. So here's what I thought I would do for these films. I'm going to cut them up into pieces as longtime listeners who have listened to other original versus remake podcasts that I've done, and I've done many. I'm going to start with the chunk of the film that opening leading up to the actual reveal of Kong. I'm going to talk about the reveal and what the first blush of looking at Kong in each film was and compare them as well. Then I'm going to go back and compare the remaining Skull Island story, so from the Kong reveal to the end of the Skull Island story, and then the last chunk will be the New York City pieces all the way through to the end, and then a little bit of back and forth comparing characters and actors, and then I will wrap up. So we're going to start with the 1933 Marion C. Cooper film starring Robert Armstrong as Carl Denham, Faye Ray as Ann Darrow, and Bruce Cabot, however you want to pronounce it, as John Driscoll, Anne's love interest. So first thing you notice in this first Kong film is that it's the old aspect ratio of 4:3, so not a widescreen experience. And if you're seeing it anywhere on widescreen, that means they've gone in and taken the square negative and, you know, put a little widescreen stamp on it, cut off the top and the bottom, discard it with disdain and find a 4:3 copy of it, because that is the real film, the way it was shot. Immediately we can hear the soundtrack, very much an important part of this film, done by Max Steiner, who was the soundtrack man years ago. There's a title card for the first Kong film, which says, quote, "And the prophet said, and lo, the beast looked upon the face of beauty, and it stayed its hand from killing, and from that day it was won as dead." End quote, old Arabian proverb. Who knows if it really is or not. But the theme of the original film, very much from beginning to end, is Beauty and the Beast. We get that theme also in the relationship with Driscoll and Anne as well. And, you know, Denham keeps mentioning it. So it's very much smack in the middle of the film. The other two films, they may play with it, but for the most part, the original film is the only film that really does it all the way through. So we open up on the docks at night, and we hear a couple of dockhands speaking about this guy, Carl Denham, and this mysterious voyage he's going to take off on, you know, on this boat. Denham, played by Robert Armstrong, who's great, just very charismatic. Now, you know, he has a very natural charm. We also see gas bombs being loaded, so right from the get-go, you know, we see what will come into play later on. And it's very much, it's an interesting idea here in that from the very beginning of the first film, the idea is for a film director to go to an island and film a big gorilla, basically, right? So it's kind of a film within a film, which I find interesting. And they don't do it as justice with the remakes as they do here. But it's just very clever that he wants to film this jungle picture. You know, he has to go to a jungle to film it because it's 1933, and you know that's what you did. He can't find any young actresses to go with him. So it's we go right to the heart of the problem. You know, we're right. And the one thing I like about the original film is the simplicity of story. It gets right to the meat of things. You're moving right along without a lot of fat, which I like. And we hear Denham complaining that the damn public wants a girl in a relationship. And I can only laugh and imagine that this is Marion Cooper putting his own frustrations with being told he needs a romance in the film by whoever was above him at wherever he was working. So that I love that he put it in there. It's kind of great. Now, one thing you have to, kind of get over in the original is it's smack dab in the 30s. So it's a lot of, I'm going to make the biggest picture in the world. Everyone's going to love it. What are them dames doing? Hey, say, kid, go get me a paper. Nah, nah. It's very much of a time, that this kind of acting. So it's the kind of acting that happened back in the day in some films, And so you're either going to be put off by it or you kind of, let it go and accept it because it's kind of the style of the day. So Denham sets off by himself in the city in search of an actress, of course, right? He finds a woman's home, which is, I guess, a mission where young women, unmarried women stayed in the city. And we have this scene where he catches a young woman named Ann Darrow stealing from a fruit stand, and he pays the fruit dealer and takes her to a coffee shop. And of course, it's actress Faye Ray. And so there's this wonderful offer, and they do it where she doesn't immediately want to go. She immediately thinks that his intentions are not on the up and up, shall we say. So there's a bit of a pushback from her, but I think she's heard of him to some degree. And so eventually she does, of course, agree to go. So we're pretty much quickly cut to the open sea. And now we meet Driscoll, who's sort of the second banana to Carl Denham. I think he might be the captain of the ship or something, or just his, the main sort of adventure leader guy. He's sort of, from the He-Man Woman Haters Club, as it were, there are these quotes of like, it's really bad. It's kind of very, very of its time where Ann Darrow's like, "You don't like me very much, do you, Jack?" And he says it very matter-of-factly, "Women can't help being a bother. Just made that way, I guess, And there's a Chinese potato peeler on the ship, dressed in sort of Chinese coolie garb, So like, you're back in the 30s. Whatever stereotypes are reigning in the day. But one thing to note, as goofy as this may be, is that the theme of Beauty and the Beast is played out with Driscoll and Ann Darrow as well. Like, so she's, she is beauty, and she's, bringing these males of two different species to heel, as it were, because as the movie goes on, Jack Driscoll completely falls in love with her, and even Denham charges him later, like, "What the hell happened to you, Jack? You used to be able to lick the world." He's like, "She got me," And of course, the theme of the movie is that she got Kong too. So, is an odd thing in here. Is the film telling us it's a positive thing or a negative thing that beauty is killing what makes these men virile men? And I can never really tell how the writers feel about it, which is just very interesting. So now we throw right in with the mystery, which is great. Denham had been given a map to an uncharted island made by the skipper of what they call a Norwegian bark, some Norwegian ship. So supposedly the Norwegians picked up the remains of a canoe, and there are some natives, and the map shows the island, and Denham describes this wall, keeping the rest of the island separate from the peninsula, very dramatically saying something they fear. But it's a great setup. Very simple, it makes sense how he got the map. Is it native superstition? Is Kong real? So just very simple, very clear setup. Then they do some filming with Ann Darrow on screen, sort of give her a screen test. And God, Faye Ray is just beautiful. She's incredibly beautiful. She puts on her her best gown, and they do these screen tests. And Denham's having her look up and scream. This is the first example of her screaming. She's a good screamer. All three movies, they get the screams really well. So, of course, she was the first and best, in my opinion. Then we get some exterior shots of the ship is called the Venture, by the way, and it's in the mist, this deep fog. We see a mountain in the distance. It kind of looks like a skull, and they arrive on Skull Island pretty easily. And we see the first matte painting from the ship's point of view, this beautiful wall in the distance as the boats approach the beach. Everything, again, it's in black and white. The whole Kong film is very much, especially on the island, it's very impressionistic. It's like the whole thing is like a German expressionist painting. And in a way, because it's shot in this black and white, the effects seem to blend better. They blend very well with the live action. Even when they're doing stuff like where you can tell the actors are in front of a screen and they film the models behind them, like because it's in black and white and filmed with this kind of haze to it, it's very believable to me. You know, if you can make the leap into a certain kind of effect in a certain kind of old movie, which, you know, I can, within that framework, it's really amazing. It really looks great. You know, they really, the paintings of that they used to set up this island are really beautiful. On the beach, they see the native canoes, right? The village is deserted. And then all the natives are now dancing around having this rite. In the, one of the guys is in gorilla garb, and we see one of the female natives is being prepared for sacrifice, and she's not very happy about it. Carl, of course, starts to film, and then they're spotted. The skipper of the venture speaks the same language as the natives, and so they're bartering, and they find out that the natives want to buy Anne, and they'll give like six of their wives, and of course, Denham and crew refuse. So then back on the boat, we have a little more of Jack and Anne, where Anne's saying, Jack, you hate all women, because Jack's starting now to fall for Anne Darrow, and there's a great line where he's like, Jack, you hate all women. Well, you ain't women, of course. And they kiss. And so, you know, Beauty has slain her first beast. Soon after, there's a raid by the natives and they capture Anne. And of course, one of the necklaces falls off of one of the raiders. The guys on the boat hear the drums on the shore. They discover Anne is gone. And so they head off in pursuit. Then we catch up with Anne and the natives. She's at the wall. Great production design. I mean, the wall looks really great. You know, I'm sure it was done back lot or in the studio. It looks very well constructed. The doors and these massive bolts that they pull back to open the doors looks very real. They lead Anne to this stone dais with these two stone pillars. Great scale when they open the doors and you see the dais sort of out in the jungle a little bit. There's something about the scale of it that looks amazing. They put her out there, tie her up, they throw the bolt, and then they all run up to the top wall to kind of witness the sacrifice of her. And then they sound this gong and we wait. So I'm going to pause there for the original and jump to the intro of the 1976 remake. Okay, so the 1976 film, we now cut, we're at 2:35 to 1, so we're in real widescreen, and it's beautiful. This film is very beautifully shot, and we get a title card, Surabaya, before we see anything, and Surabaya is a port city on the Indonesian island of Java, and we see first the oil exploration vessel, the Petrox Explorer, and we're at the docks again, very similar to the first film, a lot of pipes and construction vehicles. It's at night, and we see, more than anything, Jack Prescott, played by Jeff Bridges. So there's a Prescott character, played by Jeff Bridges. He arrives at the docks drunk and bribes a gate guard and gets in. And he sneaks aboard the ship via the anchor line just as it is about to leave port. And we briefly meet here Fred Wilson, who is the Carl Denham character. So in this remake, there is no Carl Denham, and he's played by Charles Grodin. His kind of first banana by the name of Bagley, played by, I think it's pronounced René Auberjonois, who is Odo for the biggest part of his career, played Odo on Star Trek Deep Space Nine. So we get an initial montage of the Petrox Explorer out at sea. We don't know a thing yet about anything, about why it's there, what's going on. We get credits. We've got a nighttime storm immediately during dinner with the captain. And we find out that somehow this guy Wilson is on the board of, or has talked to the board of some major energy company, and he's kind of sold them on the idea that this hidden island in the area that's producing massive amounts of oil. And we're not exactly sure how and why he's found this island, but we will find out soon, and it's a really cool thing. So we get him, says that his ass is on the line. He's taking a real gamble because of some secret information that he's come across in terms of, you know, some oil on this island. So the immediate setup, which is kind of cool because this isn't Carl Denham out to make a movie. In a sense, this is a story that begins with a character and a group of people looking for petroleum deposits and stumbling upon Kong, which is great. I think it's a great updating of that, especially, you know, in the 70s, right? The oil, the energy crisis that would be about energy and finding more oil and more petroleum. So I think it's great. And it's mounted really well. Like the 76 one is mounted well. I'll get to that when I kind of compare them a little bit. But you're in a real movie here. Like the 33 one is, you know, I love it. But it's a bit of an anachronism at this point. But, you know, this film, like, it's very well shot, very well mounted. Like, you know, when you start out, you're like, ah, okay, you know, this is a real film. Like, it looks very professional and very well done. So at that point, the radio man gets a mayday from a ship out somewhere, and we basically just get the mayday, and then we cut away. So then we get this whole briefing, which is really, this is a really great introduction. And Wilson does the briefing, and we find out that in 1943, there's a Navy photograph of this area and a fog bank compared with a photograph that was taken in the same area 2 weeks ago, same angle, same fog, that it doesn't change all these years. The fog stays in this one area. Because of a goof in a NASA flyby, one of their satellites photographed the island, and we hear that Wilson bribed some politician to get the photo. During all this, Jeff Bridges' character Prescott sneaks in. So in the back where no one can see him, he sneaks into the briefing. So Wilson continues that the satellite took infrared photographs and that behind the fog was an actual island, and they got some spectrograph data, and the chemical composition of the fog lead them to believe that vapors from the ground are coming from petroleum deposits that have breached and that are even on the surface. So cool idea, right? I mean, I think that's a really, really well thought out premise, frankly. In a sense, it's not a mystery of like the secret island where a giant, I mean, that kind of comes from Jeff Bridges a little bit yet, but that it's still kind of that the island was hidden for a reason. And that, I don't know, I think it was just a very well thought out premise. And if you're going to remake a film, that to come up with something as well thought out as this to start out, I was like, yeah, this is great, you know? So now Prescott reveals himself. And we get a little bit of the original film did where he says in 1605, there was a log from a famous explorer that landed on a beach and heard the roar of a giant beast. In 1749, there was something about a waterlogged lifeboat, and on the lifeboat, drawn in blood, the likeness of a huge beast. Then Prescott quotes from something he has in his hand, from the wedding with the creature that touches heaven, may the God preserve thee, right? So now we get the Prescott character is the one who's heard the mystery of the giant ape, and he's trying to get there. So he is from the Department of Primate Paleontology. Immediately, Wilson thinks he's a spy for another energy company, which I think is a really good plot device because, you know, he feels like he's onto something huge and that he's, you know, afraid that any other energy company would put someone on board to kind of see what he's up to. And so Prescott's story is that the reason why he's on board is that no one had asked for charts of the area for years, tipping him off. The captain of the ship says, yeah, I had to ask for charts from a local dealer because we don't know these waters, which is kind of, but Wilson still doesn't believe him. So he's going to have him checked out and confined to quarters. So great setup. Really, really like the setup in this one a lot. On the way to him being confined to quarters, he spies something out in the ocean, which turns out to be a lifeboat containing the last survivor of this ship that we heard the mayday for earlier, and her name is Dwan, D-W-A-N, played by Jessica Lange in her first film appearance. And again, this is, they have to, if they're going to continue to do the ape and girl angle, that you have to get a girl on board the boat. If you're going to set it up differently where you're not going to do a guy's out to make a motion picture, so he needs an actress, how are you going to get a girl on board a boat that's going to go to Skull Island? And it's a little bit of a coincidence, right? But it's not a huge one. And it's, I don't know, it's I can kind of swallow it in the spirit of this story. So not bad. So Prescott checks out via the Pringle Prince. He is who he says he is. But then Wilson decides to use him as the expedition's official photographer, which I thought was very clever because, you know, what else, what other use would they have from him on board? The film would want us to just kind of make him part of the expedition just because, you know, he's the character. He's going to be the love interest for Dwan, who's the, you know, Ann Darrow character in this film. But he actually, you know, he's packing a ton of cameras. So Wilson's like, look, you know, you're gonna go to work here as a stowaway. You're going to be our official photographer. So I like that, you know, again, very well thought out. Dwan is an actress, so it's a little bit of a nod towards the original film. The guy whose boat she was on was going to put her in a movie in Hong Kong. So again, a little nod towards the original. And they give Jessica Lange a long scene here, which is kind of dumb. It's just not very well. I mean, she's painted as kind of a dumb, airheaded blonde in the film, which is, you know, whatever. And we get the story of why she was on deck. The bizarre story was that the entire crew was in the cabin watching Deep Throat, and she was kind of offended by it, so she went up on deck when the storm hit, and that's how she survived, which was like kind of a weird little plot device. Then we have this, you know, montage of Dwan on board. She gets clothes from the crew. She's sewing them together to make them more feminine, and we hear this perky love theme, you know, and this is the part of the movie. This actually could have been a pretty good serious monster movie. But the whole thing with Dwan on the ship and Dwan on the, you know, on the island is played for comedy a lot, and they did that on purpose. But it just doesn't really work. It's really kind of goofy. There's a shower scene with just her. You know, it's like we get a long look at Jessica Lange kind of in the shower. I mean, not naked, but it's like this is the girl. You know, so a little bit of a 70s exploitation vibe going on. Not much. So they reach the fog bank, and it looks very epic. It reminds me of a very similar shot in the trailer for Kong Skull Island. Coming out off to the side, you see this fog bank. Very epic. The radar they have picks up the island, and there's this moment where the radar shows the island, and there's this single red dot. And they think it's a glitch, of course. We'll come to find out later that that was Kong roaring, right? Which is kind of cool. Tuan talks her way on board the expedition to the island in a way that's extremely unbelievable. You know, in a sense, she kind of charms Wilson a little bit and flirts with him, but it's kind of goofy. And she's mostly annoying now, talking about, you know, what's your horoscope, and that, you know, the last time her cards were read, she was told she was going to cross over water and meet the biggest person in her life. Like, haha, okay. But everything looks great here. The fog looks great. The ship, very good, like 70s epic photography, man. This film explains is this freak of water current. The fog breaks right before they hit the island, which is, you know, good for us, so we can see the bloody thing. They have brought geological charges with them to sort of do seismic analysis of the island. Beautiful shots of the island. And it was filmed in Kauai, which I believe is around Hawaii, so really beautiful exterior shots, giving the film, you know, some much-needed realism, which, you know, it's great to have that. So then we get the wall, which is, I love the wall in this film. It's a matte painting, but man, it's done really well. It's very epic. It's very Spielbergian in a way. We first zoom in to the reactions of all of the landing party, and then we flip to the wall, and it's amazing. And the difference in this film is that the villagers live inside of a sort of a stockade where the wall goes all the way around where they live, rather than a wall that kind of is cutting off a peninsula from something else on the island. So, but it looks really, really great. And I mean, matte paintings done well and photographed well can be very effective. You know, you don't need CGI for every bloody thing. And there's just something refreshing when you see it, a good matte painting. There's something, you know, it's really there and light is really reflecting off of it, giving it. If the painting is really good, you know, it's very hard to detect unless it's kind of something fantastical, but it's great. So Prescott's the one, they think the wall is ancient, but Prescott notices that it's been recently maintained and that there's fresh earth plugging, you know, chinks in it. And then immediately we hear the drumming. So we cut to the inside of the stockade. We see the villagers. Our team somehow finds their way in with this massive wall. We don't know how they do it, but they're observing. Very similar to the first film, they see a woman on a sort of this pallet who's being prepared to be sacrificed. The costumes and production design are good, not too colorful. You know, they look pretty realistic to me. And they see oil bubbling up in pits all around the village, which gets Denim very excited. So they're seen, and they don't do the language in this one. Jack doesn't speak the language. Prescott has to kind of guess. But it's the same thing that the headman wants Dwan, and it's going to give six of his women for Dwan. And in this one, they fire guns in the air and scatter the villagers and head back to the ship. So over dinner, they're discussing about how they're going to treat the natives to get the oil. And it's Prescott versus Wilson, basically. And Prescott tells them about the legend of Kong and that the wall is there to keep something really massive out. Basically, Wilson's sort of like, you know what, we'll give them a bunch of trinkets, we'll buy their island from them and send them off, or basically going to displace them or kill them if they resist. And Prescott's kind of really horrified by that, so he prepares to go to the island alone. And him and Dwan bump into each other, and we have this moment very similar to the first film right before she gets taken, where, you know, the male and female lead kind of realize they want to get together. He leaves her briefly, and they're supposed to, like, meet back at his room, and then, boom, the natives grab her. And when he returns to where they were standing together, we see the necklace. So, we, you know, again, same deal, same drill. She's been taken. And then we cut to her being garbed in the same outfit as we saw the native in earlier. And in this one, she's drugged, which I guess leads to her not screaming so much in the beginning. It makes sense. They give her this potion to drink. We see the gate. Looks very a bit like the original. They do a little extra bit here where they pour oil over the bolt to kind of grease it so they can move it, which I thought was a nice little detail. They have a similar altar with these twin pillows. Looks very epic. Of the whole congregation coming out of the stockade, coming towards the altar, you know, like the camera's up high, and we're immediately getting a sense that, you know, something spectacular is about to happen. So really well shot. And then we cut back to the crew of the ship, knowing that Dwan has been taken. They've come ashore and forced a lot of weapons. And then, you know, we're about to experience Kong. All right, so I'm going to pause there, and we're going to do the intro up to the reveal from Peter Jackson's 2005 film. So, again, Jackson's film is a period piece done in as if we were in 1933, and we open in New York City. We start, you know, the Depression and we're seeing shanty towns and this incredible montage. It looks great, actually. There is a bit of a sheen over this intro, and as a, most of the film, very much a sheen that we've come to know from Lord of the Rings, which I thought worked really well in Rings, but to me doesn't work that well here, because after a while, the whole bloody thing looks just so fake that I never know when to take it seriously. So, but I like it as a place setter, like, oh, we're in 1933. So we open with Ann Darrow. We're back to Darrow and Carl Denham, right? So it's a complete remake of the first film. We see Ann Darrow playing kind of a vaudeville, you know, off-Broadway thing, played by actress Naomi Watts. And we're getting a sense that times are not good for the troupe. The theater winds up closing, and so she's out of work. And so she's got, supposedly she just has a character arc where they set up a friend of hers saying every time she reaches out for something, fate comes to snatch it away. Okay, fine. And she wants to be in Jack Driscoll's play. So Jack Driscoll in this film is a playwright. We had Prescott in the 76 remake, and we had Jack Driscoll as sort of the first mate in the original film. So in this film, Jack, they do change it where he is a playwright and she's dying to get in his play. She chases some down some agent who says, you know, we're not going to cash you in that, but here's a place you can go to make some money, and it's sort of a house of ill repute. Then we cut and we meet Carl Denham, played by Jack Black, very kind of Orson Wellesian character, very much like the original. He's a director screening a Jungle Picture for these producers who hate it. Even though they hate the movie, Denham says, look, I want to rewrite and reshoot the whole thing because I've come upon this map of an uncharted island, a Pacific. No one's ever filmed there before. It'll be a special thing. And the producers pretty much scrap the entire idea. But where there's an initial dramatic thing where, you know, before they can send word to the ship to stop him from leaving, he has to rush around to get everything on the ship, get everything he needs, and leave port before the suits can kind of put the kibosh on it. And already there's kind of like this madcap vibe in this film with Jack Black in the lead, and he's never very good. To me, he's always mugging, and even when he has to deliver serious lines, and I'll get to that when I compare the actors and the characters, but there is a madcap energy to this movie. It's like, like we're going to get to the ship, and it's always like one step away from it being kind of a funny pie-in-your-face type of thing. And the original film was serious in its way, and the 70s film was very serious, and this is very different. And I think it runs into a lot of problems when it wants to get serious at certain points as it's going to come, you know, as to come, when it kind of fights against itself as what does it want to be. But from this opening, we realize that it really wants to be a very kid-friendly film. It wants to be very, very much like, you know, we're going to inject a lot of humor in here. We're not completely taking this seriously, and it's kind of a romp. And I just find it a weird tone to take with this kind of a movie. At this point, you know, you're on board, and you're like, okay, you know, if you make this work, you make it work. So I'm on board, but I am noticing very much the vibe that he's setting. So like the original, he needs an actress for this part, and he's got to run out and find her, and he goes to this sort of burlesque theater. I guess it wasn't a brothel. Burlesque theater where Anne was going to be going later, and he's watching women go in and out. Anne's behind him across the street. So she, you know, she's a good girl in our movie. She never went in. She throws the card that the agent he gave her down and starts to walk away. But Carl sees her in the reflection. And then we do a whole recap of her stealing fruit to eat and Denham buying the fruit for her. Then we have a coffee shop scene between the two of them. And she outright refuses to do it until she hears that Jack Driscoll is writing the film as a fan of his play. So I feel like Jackson and his writers kind of felt that, you know, the original Ann Darrow to say, you know, I'm going to go on a ship full of men, you know, for weeks at a time. I don't know where I'm going. I don't know what we're doing. It's just going to be me and a complete ship full of men. Like, she would have never done it. So they add the little bit in this film that, you know, if Jack Driscoll's her hero and he's writing it, that she's on board. So that's clever. Now we're at the docks at night. The ship is named The Venture as the original. And we get this whole thing where the cops are en route to stop him because the studio kind of had gotten wind that he's trying to take off on them. Adrian Brody enters the film as Jack Driscoll. There's so much. I mean, this film is so hyper intensive. You have the cops coming, so he's got to get away before the cops come. So he's got to get back to the ship before the cops get there. Then he needs Jack Driscoll to stay on the ship to write the movie. And Jack basically gave him a treatment and is about to leave. So there's this thing of like Denham distracting Jack by writing checks wrong. And he has to keep, you know, oh, you didn't spell my name right. So again, it's just we're starting with, I don't like about Jackson's film is that it's so overstuffed with drama. You know, they put everything has to be like on 10, and he tries to wring out as much as he can from every single scene that you're exhausted even before the movie kind of gets going. And this is one of them. It's like, just set the bloody story. You know, set up the story and go already. Like, you know, you have this whole race to the ship and will Driscoll get off or get on and will Anne make it and all this crap. Like, to me, it's just, it's too much. It's kind of modern movie making at its worst, where it's like, as I've said in other podcasts, like sometimes as modern moviegoers, like we're so jaded, you know, like we're so desensitized. We've seen everything and we've seen everything on 10. How are you going to, you know, up the ante? And I feel like, I think a straight story well told it still works in any day, in any time, in any genre. I don't think you have to do all this crap. But anyway, part of what's going to really hurt this film for me is just the exhaustion I experience watching it. And it starts right from the beginning. So then we have an extended sea voyage, which to me, it just drags the film out. We see in this film, it's chloroform bottles. I think it was gas bombs in the original, which is pretty much the same. I don't remember how they do it. I don't think they got to how they did it in the remake yet, 76 remake. But here we see these massive bottles of chloroform on board, and there's a long scene between Anne and Driscoll where, you know, she mistakes someone else for him, a really kind of handsome ship guy, and it's like, let's go already. You know, there are all these comedic bits on board the ship, these hijinks about what people have, you know, Jack's writing in a cage in storage. They don't do anything to build character, and I think if you're going to do anything on the sea voyage, you got to build character. And I think what Jackson and his writers think they're doing is building character, but they're not. They're doing this kind of like an old style version of hijinks entertainment, and it's not building character. Nothing matters here. It's a long scene between Jack and Carl talking about the island, which doesn't matter. Then we do some filming on board. It's clever, but we see what they're filming on board is actual dialogue from the original movie. Okay, haha, right? That's very clever, Peter Jackson. There's a chance meeting in a hallway between Anne and Jack. They try for a connection. And I don't believe anything that's going on here. Like, I don't believe that there isn't a scene in the sea voyage that in any way feels real or honest at all. It's just a lot of mugging. Even the soundtrack is like a lot of flutes, you know, you know, and then what's going to happen next? Oh, they've bumped into each other in the hallway. But it's just, it's exhausting. There's a brief mention of the Norwegian bark, of how Carl got the map to the island. We hear that. It's not, in a weird way, it's not as menacing as in the first film because you've got this hijinky kind of tone. It doesn't come across really in a sense in this film. So to me, nothing really is making me feel ominous, as I should be feeling ominous at this point, and I'm not. Then we have a montage of the voyage because we haven't spent enough time on board setting things up, which does nothing for the film. We see Driscoll is in love with Anne, and we don't really know why because we haven't been given any real character development with Anne. Their scenes together are kind of nothing, and he writes a play for her, but there's no chemistry between Adrian Brody and Naomi Watts at all, and they finally have this kiss which has no spark to it. Like, in its own goofy way, like, I believed the romance in the original because it kind of just, it worked. And I don't, you know, the 76 film I don't buy for a minute, nor do I buy this one. So now we have yet another dramatic thing where a wire comes into the ship that there's a warrant out for Carl's arrest and the captain has orders to divert to Rangoon. So it's like more conflict. You know, we don't need all this crap. And there's no stars now due to cloud cover, so they can't get to Rangoon. The map blows out of Denham's hands. And the Venture gets lost in a fog bank. And then, like, so they finally island, you know, unwittingly and unwillingly. You know, they get into the fog bank, and finally we come not to the island yet, but to a monstrous wall of stone in the water. And we have another dramatic tension moment where the ship has to get through the wall to get to the freaking island. Oh, my God. It's like, enough already. There's no stakes to it. Nobody cares. And then finally we see the island through the fog, and you know, with all the CGI and all the power that Jackson has at his command, like, the island doesn't look very impressive. It's weird. It just doesn't look that great. There's a lot of fog, and it looks kind of like one of the sequences in Lord of the Rings, but it kind of doesn't work here. I don't know. It's weird. Now the ship has a leak, so there's another thing of, like, the ship is taking water, and they don't have much time, so Denham and the crew now row to shore while the rest of the crew stays on board to fix the leak, and it's like, oh, my God, I'm already exhausted. So they get to the island and we see all these skulls in the water, skulls, you know, everything shaped like a skull, but none of it scares or looms up. Again, because of the film's tone, like, now they're trying to do a scary skull island and it does not work. They're quoting Joseph Conrad now. They have this first mate who will wind up dying on the island is quoting Conrad, and like no quote of Joseph Conrad is going to go in this kind of a movie with this kind of tone. So, you know, I already feel the movie is fighting itself. And then the final wall, keeping, you know, they do the Kong wall basically, but it just looks like Osgiliath from Rings. It's too CGI. It has that black and white kind of gray sheen to it. Even the gate is kind of very uninteresting. So, I mean, half of these sets to me belong in Lord of the Rings, where they did a very similar type of set design, and to me, it doesn't work in this film. Now, there's a bizarre shift in tone, where the villagers kind of emerge out of this deserted town, and it's like they're basically like orcs. They're very bloody and gruesome and intensely shot, and you, all of a sudden, a cast member is killed. You hear a giant roar in the distance. He's using a slow-mo style a lot so we can get a lot of the blood and the death that's happening in this battle. There's a beheading. And it's an incredible jarring shift into a sort of horror movie violence that is so different from kind of the jokey tone that's been happening in the film where we are that it just doesn't, to me, it doesn't work. I don't know what, I'm watching like another movie all of a sudden. So they're rescued by the remaining crew and back on the ship. They're trying to refloat the ship off the rock, right? More drama. There's one cool thing where the natives get out to the ship by jumping on these huge poles from one large sort of rock outcropping to another, which is kind of a neat little idea in the midst of all this nonsense. But one comes on board, drops his necklace, and grabs Anne, very similar. But it's in the middle of the ship disaster, and they finally find out that she's missing, of course, and they have to go out and get her. And now we're back to Anne with the natives, and again, we're back to the horror movie vibe, which is good. It's very pungent and kind of gross, but again, it doesn't mix with what we've seen before. The conch ceremony starts. The scope should be way more epic, but it's so CGI, and it just has that sheen to it that this entire film has that looks, it never ever looks real. It always looks like I'm in like a comic book. And it's also way too big. Some of the stuff looks like, you know, in the two movies that have preceded it, the stuff looked about right size, like giant, but that it could have been made by the natives. But the stuff here on Skull Island, it doesn't look like it could have been made by the people that we've come into contact with. It's very weird. Just way too epic for the villagers, right? And maybe it's not supposed to. Maybe they even, it's supposed to be this ancient place. But again, it's just, I'm out of it. You know, I'm like, what are you, is this Lord of the Rings? Like, where's, you know, where's Gollum? Is Gollum coming to this? It's just really weird. From here, they have this very elaborate thing where they put her in this sort of cherry picker, which leans out and places her out from the wall for Kong, like a big fork, you know, and we'll pause there. We'll pause there to compare the three films. So, look, the original film and the 1976 film are both earnest, very solid introductions. They each tell this story with without a lot of BS. They're very well thought out. I think each one knows what it wants to do. It just does it. And pretty much tells their story without a lot of crap. The only little bit maybe in the 76 movie, you have the Dwan story and, you know, her on board, which is going to begin to be this kind of light comic tone that threads into that remake, which is not, doesn't really work in my mind. You know, they set up the charisma between the male and female leads in the first film, which is very believable, you know, in its way. The Dwan, Jack Driscoll thing doesn't really work in the original, but okay, you know, whatever. The Denham character in the first film, Robert Armstrong, is fantastic. I don't love the Denham character in the 76 remake, but his reasons for being and doing what he's doing are real, and they make sense to me. And it's very well thought out that he's just kind of this, you know, in between, he's kind of an oil executive who's trying to just score one for the board. So I buy that. And the story that why he's out there is really well thought out. The problem really here is Jackson's 2005 remake. Like, the high jinky tone that he's setting in this film and the comedy that's actually not funny unless you're maybe 5 years old. They don't build any character. I don't really care about any of these people. I do care about the characters in the original. I care about the Jeff Bridges character. For whatever reason, Jessica Lange makes me care a little bit about her goofy, you know, dumb blonde character. I like Anne Darrow and Driscoll Denham in the original, right? I think they're, you know, for what they are. Like, I like all the characters, and I know who they are and what they want and what they're doing. In the Jackson's film, I don't know anything. I don't really care because he's doing so many other things and very visibly that you know that he's not really focusing on the story and the characters. He just wants to kind of make a kid's film in a weird way. And he's CGI happy with this movie like you would not believe. And, you know, comparing the characters, I really love the original Carl Denham. I mean, Robert Armstrong is just a very charismatic actor. For all of his, all right, see, this movie's going to be a big picture. For all that, I like him. And I like Fay Wray over Dwan. Actually, Jeff Bridges' character in the 76 remake I prefer over the, because Jeff Bridges is great, you know, like, and he's taken it very seriously in the movie. So he brings a level of believability to the film where he's kind of like the grizzled, kind of the Indiana Jones kind of character in the 76 film that gives it a little bit of heft that I like, you know, because he's a terrific actor and he's not mailing it in, like he's serious about it. So I really like him. For me, you know, the original and the 76 remake are both solid up till now. Like, the 76 remake probably is a little more realistic, works a little more, but the original is very solid for what it's doing, and it's just telling its story straight. And Jackson's film, like, I'm already exhausted, and I haven't even seen Kong yet.
This is the 24th century. Material needs no longer exist.
As lovely a dream as that is, which is why I love Trek so much, it is still the 21st century, and monetary needs are unfortunately still very much with us. And I just want to tell you briefly some ways you can support sci-fi on screen. One way is to subscribe to Patreon.com. And Patreon is very good for podcasters because you can sign up with Patreon and you can choose to donate as little as a dollar per episode. And so every time I actually upload an episode, you would get debited. And you can change the amount whenever you like. You can stop whenever you like. So, you know, you're not just giving money indiscriminately per month or per week. Only when I put up a show do you contribute. There's also PayPal. If you want to do a one-time donation, you can go to PayPal. Use scifionscreen@gmail.com. Email address. And you can donate from there. And non-monetary ways to support the podcast, please share the show on your Facebook page, retweet it, tell your friends, skywrite it, name a star after it, if you will. You know, do a review on iTunes, just kind of get the word out. And I have a dream someday of making this my sole source of income. And I think, you know, sometimes when I have several thousand downloads of a show, I thought, well, if every person who downloaded that show, you know, donated a dollar, I wouldn't have a day job. So just putting that in people's hats. And if you can't afford it, please just enjoy the show.
Gonna crack my knuckles and jump for joy. I got a clean bill of health from Dr. McCoy.
Okay, so now I'm going to compare the reveals of Kong. In the original film, the first reveal of Kong, Kong's at 42 minutes in. The 1976 version comes at 53 minutes in, and Jackson's 2005 version comes in hour 10. So, you know, slowly, you know, each remake is doing a little bit more before we see Kong, but not, you know, so much so. First you hear the roar, which is pretty good, and then Kong appears in all his stop-motion glory, which looks great. You know, there are times when it definitely looks fake, but it works. And I think it works for a couple of reasons. The perspective given often, we, you know, against trees and against Anne, like we get a sense of how big Kong is. And he's pretty much a biped, you know, stands upright, the least ape-like, or the least, you know, I guess the 76 movie doesn't do much more actually, but, you know, very much upright. And when you're very close up on Kong's face, it's an actual thing in the screen where it's a face that was built. And I'm going to get to how each Kong was kind of put together after I compare them. But, you know, you see human eyeballs in the face that's really close up, which does work. And there's kind of a Rankin and Bass Abominable Snowman thing going on with the original Kong. We get a lot of long shots. We can really take him in. There's a pretty long take of him standing in front of Anne, you know, and we see real Fay Wray writhing in her, you know, bonds. And Kong is looming over her. And then the juxtaposition of the two is seamless. Like, it really works. So that's the reveal in the original. In the 76 film, you hear the footsteps a little bit more and you see trees moving. Immediately, it looks more fake than the original because they're trying to do everything in miniature. So there's no stop motion at all. There's just miniature trees moving. Then there's a shot that's like point of view of Kong walking through the forest as if you were Kong. So the camera's kind of pointed forward and trees are parting left and right, which is a cool idea. And trees are falling in front of the camera. And then, you know, we get up to Dwan and the camera is looking down. So we're getting a sense of like how large Kong is by putting the audience in the perspective, which is clever. They do another super close-up of the eyes and face, and we don't really get a sense of size yet. Then the first perspective shot, he's towering over Dwan like the original movie, but it's a guy in a suit and it just doesn't look real. There's a giant hand come out to get Dwan, which is definitely, you know, a mechanical hand that was created for the movie. I think the three movies, I think there was a mechanical hand for all three in those kind of close-up shots. I'm not sure of Jackson's movie, but it looks okay. You know, in the original film and in this remake, the big hands that come out to grab her look fine. They're not long in long shots, so you don't really mind it so much. But in the remake, I never get the sense of awe of looking at Kong like I do in the original and like I do in Jackson's movie. And I don't know why. I just think there's something about when you're filming a guy in a suit, there's something about everything's too fast. Like, there's something about delayed, like the stop motion and the CGI. Because of the size of Kong, I think everything moves like a little bit slower, even the hair on his body. Everything kind of acts in the frame a little bit slower than normal, giving you that sense of like, this is a larger character than normal. I don't know how that works, but it kind of does. But in the Man in the Suit Kong, you don't get that. You know, you could tell the guy's moving a little slow, or they did it a little bit in slow motion. But either way, there's just something about it that does not work. The way that, in my mind, none of the Man in the Suit Godzilla movies worked. You know, they're hoots to watch, and you know, they're fun, but they never really work as cinema. They really are just goofy and fake. So unfortunately, you know, most of the Kong shots in the 76 remake don't work. And it's a shame because the movie surrounding it is serious and it's trying to, you know, it's trying its best to make a real film out of this idea. So Jackson's film, we're 1 hour and 10 minutes in, and we see trees moving and we hear footsteps. And then the first reveal of Kong really is kind of a bait and switch because we see a shape, we see fur, we see a hand. We don't see a complete shot until later in the film. We just get a sense of how big Kong is, and then the hand comes for Anne. And then you kind of see it, but it's fully enveloped in fog, so it's not complete. And I think with all CGI, from my perspective, seeing so many CGI films, that when the CGI creatures are at night, or there's raining, or they have to interact with the environment, they look so much more real than if they're just standing there in the daytime, fully CGI, when you see all the flaws and you get a sense of how fake it is, because optically, it just never really can compete with the live action, just the way the light hits real things and the way computer animated things mimic light hitting them. Like, it never seems the same. Jackson's very smart here in that it's all enveloped in fog, and it's kind of like we get a sense of how big it is, and the roar is great, and then it's gone. So I mean, if I'm going to compare the three, it really Jackson's Kong is a triumph here. First of all, it moves and looks like a real gorilla. It's on all fours most of the time. It's got this huge, it really looks like a big silverback gorilla when you see it in a lot of full shots. And it moves like one. And it's basically, I mean, you got Andy Serkis in there, so it's kind of not fair. You know, the greatest motion capture actor of our generation is Kong. You know, and it just looks amazing as a full-on gorilla. Like, they don't make it a monster that stands on two legs, which I think in some aspects, from what I've seen in the trailer to Kong Skull Island, I think they're going to go a little bit back and do Kong as kind of a bipedal Godzilla type thing. But in Jackson's film, it's just a huge gorilla. And it really feels and looks like one in all ways. So I think Jackson's film is the least film of the three, and I'll get to that when I summarize. But it's the best looking version of Kong, in my opinion. So I want to take a little sidetrack into what went into the making of Kong in the original film in 76, and a little bit of Jackson's movie, but the Jackson's movie was pretty much CGI. So the original film, lots of different models of different shapes and sizes were created depending on what was being filmed. You know, the giant head was made for close-ups with Anne, and there were lots of different sizes of stop-motion models to go with different sets. You know, if the set was the Empire State Building or the Jungle Island, so on and so forth. Basically, you know, this was a triumph of stop-motion animation by this guy Willis O'Brien and his assistant, this guy Buzz Dixon. And the scenes were painstaking and difficult to achieve and complete after the special effects crew realized that they couldn't stop because it would make the movements of the creature seem inconsistent and the lighting wouldn't be the same, which is the interesting thing. So whenever they had to do stop-motion scenes, complete scenes, they had to kind of do it all in one shot. They had to go through until they finished because they would never be able to set up the lights in the same way. And it just, you know, the setup would be different. And they discovered that if you put all these, you know, if you did stop-motion animation over different days and you put it together, it wasn't seamless, which is kind of fascinating. So Kong and the 76 film were all masks and men in suits. And giant arms and hands, basically. Seven different masks were created by this guy, Carlo Rambaldi, and molded by Rick Baker, who's also a famous special effects guy, to convey various emotions. Separate masks were necessary, as there were too many cables and mechanics required for all expressions to fit into one single mask. And they were composed, the masks, of a plastic skull over which were placed artificial muscle groups activated by cables which entered the costume through Kong's feet, with the outer latex skins molded by Baker placed over the top. The masks used hydraulics to provide movement, so much like the mechanical Kong and hands, the facial expressions were controlled by the team of operators working offset with the control boards. To complete the look of a gorilla, Baker wore contact lenses so his eyes would resemble those of a gorilla. So when you're seeing all the facial expressions in Kong's face in the remake of 76, it's all done in camera by Baker and all these guys, you know, rigging it from behind the scenes and using different masks to achieve different expressions, which is great. So, of course, 2005 Jackson, you know, fully CGI. Jackson saw Kong as an opportunity for technical innovations in motion capture, commissioning Christian Rivers of Weta Digital to supervise all aspects of Kong's performance. Jackson decided early on that he did not want Kong to behave like a human, and so he and his team studied hours of gorilla footage. Andy Serkis, who was cast, prepared himself by working with gorillas at the London Zoo. He then traveled to Rwanda, observing the actions and behaviors of gorillas in the wild. Rivers explained that the detailed facial performance capture with Serkis was accomplished because of the similarities between human and gorilla faces. Quote, "Gorillas have such a similar-looking set of eyes and brows, you can look at those expressions and transpose your own interpretation onto them," end quote. Photos of silverback gorillas were also superimposed on Kong's image in the early stages of animation. And Serkis had to go through 2 hours of motion capture makeup every day, having 135 small markers attached to different spots on his face. Following principal photography, Serkis had to spend an additional 2 months on a motion capture stage, miming Kong's movements for the film's digital animators. So, just a brief little info dump on how the various Kongs were made. All right, so we're going to jump back in, and we're going to kind of talk about the remaining story on Skull Island for the three films. So we'll start with the original film, and I just want to say that the original film, the shots of the jungle just look beautiful. It's a very convincing kind of fantasy jungle place, and it's just done with this haze of, you know, black and white 30s photography, where either the whole thing is unbelievable or you believe the whole thing is a representation of something fantastic, but incredibly tangible, you know? So I love it. It gives Skull Island a real mystery and a real sense of menace, more than I think any of the other two films do. It's a really fantastical, mysterious place. It kind of jumps out of like a German expressionist painting. Like, so I'll say that over and over again, because so many shots reminded me just of that, those paintings of that era that I like so much. Caspar David Friedrich and similar artists, where there's just this romantic, lush sense of those paintings, and also of, similarly, of how this was filmed. There's a beautiful shot of a stegosaurus. The first time we see a large monster in the original, it's off in the distance. It's a beautiful shot, and it's, you know, wonderful stop motion, and then it charges right at them, and they use a gas bomb on it, which works temporarily, knocking it down, which, again, you know, as goofy as the original movie can be, its story bones are strong, right? It has this sort of Beauty and the Beast theme going from the very beginning. Now we've seen what they're going to use on Kong used on another animal, so it's not such a surprise when they use the gas bombs on Kong. Like, you know, these are good story chops. These are, like, the things that make a movie repeatedly watchable, because some part of your subconscious is like, this all makes sense. So they actually kill the stag with a rifle after it's been knocked out, and they all walk past it as it's dead, giving it scale. And this is definitely a rear screen projection. They projected up large in the screen, you know, a stop motion shot of the stag dying and then dead, and then the real actors walk by the screen and they film all of that, and it looks great. There's a wonderful, spooky sequence in a swamp, you know, where it cracks me up, they battle a brontosaurus, and a brontosaurus is like a serious herbivore, like it wouldn't hurt a fly. You know, this is the most carnivorous man-eating brontosaurus we've ever seen, you know, and we see this long neck and head come up out of the water towards them, and it's great. And because of the fog in the swamp, it hides the imperfections of the brontosaurus. Several men are died, and one guy tries to hide up in a tree, and the brontosaurus basically, with, you know, long fangs, right, eats him. So it's kind of funny. Then we get the inevitable tree trunk scene, which is in every one of these films, where, you know, Kong finally comes out of hiding and confronts the men chasing him to find Anne, and turns the log left and right to knock most of the crew off the log. And it looks great. Again, you know, it all kind of looks seamless. This is another one of those composite shots where you have the live action and the rolling log, and you have the stop motion Kong off to the right. It blends really great. Okay, so then soon after that, you have, which, you know, the piece de resistance in this film. You know, obviously the last scene on the Empire State Building is the big scene, but I love Kong versus the T-Rex, and it's amazing. And the T-Rex is so cool, and why I think this fight is really good, it's kind of what they tried to do in the 76 remake, which they didn't do in Jackson's film. It's a real fight, and it's like, it's Kong and this thing going at it for real, and it's not like, they don't try to do anything else but do the fight. And they do it in this way where they, you know, again, it's rear screen projection. So we see Anne in most of it giving it scale, but it's a great fight, man. And Kong flips it over. He's a little smaller than the T-Rex, so he's a little at a disadvantage. And it's just a really cool fight. They knock this tree over that Anne's on, which gives it, you know, more of a sense of like they're in the same frame together, which is kind of cool. And then a great brutal last moment when it breaks the T-Rex's jaw, which is just terrific. And this black blood comes dripping out of it. Very, very gruesome scene, but very cool. Then we get Kong in his cave. And again, the cave lair, this beautiful, impressionistic, kind of hazy, the lights coming in from one side, just beautifully shot. And now Driscoll is nearby, as he's the last kind of, him and Denham kind of made it past the tree, and Denham basically has gone back to the boat to get more men, and Driscoll was going to continue on to try to get Anne away from Kong. And so now there's a fight between Kong and a snake, and it's another great fight. It completely surrounds him, this giant lizard, and he finally slams it down along with the soundtrack cues, you know, so when he's hitting it against the ground, and Max Steiner is going right along with it, which is kind of cool. And then he takes Anne up to this wonderful parapet where he fights a pterodactyl or a pterosaur, if you will. He beats his chest up there, you know, kind of doing his king of the domain thing, and faints. Then, you know, we start with the relationship stuff where Kong starts to take off some of her clothing. But here it's done like she's a doll and he's just kind of playing with her, whereas in the 76 remake, it's a little creepy. There is a little playfulness here where Kong's trying to tickle her. And we get a humorous soundtrack cue as well where, you know, there is a sense now that, like, he is trying to, you know, that there is something between them. But before it can go too much further, this giant pterosaur attacks. And while Kong is distracted, Driscoll nearby comes out and grabs her. You know, another great fight with the pterosaur, which all the fights are really good in this movie. And Kong breaks its neck at this point. Driscoll grabs Anne and they shimmy down this vine, which Kong starts to pull up to get them back, and then they let go and fall into a river. Anne and Driscoll get back. Then, you know, they have the whole scene where they capture Kong. It's great when he pushes through the gate, his size and presence versus all the humans around him. Again, it's another great composite shot when he smashes the gate open. It's a really, you know, majestic scene. And he goes on his rampage, fighting some natives who are on the scaffold throwing spears. You know, there's a close-up of one native in Kong's jaws getting eaten. And he basically pounds the village apart, killing indiscriminately as he goes. It's pretty brutal, actually, which I think is good. He's stepping on people, he's eating them, he's grabbing them and flinging them. All natives, of course, right? 1933. Grinds his heel into a guy. And then finally he gets to the shore and the gas bombs go off and he drops. And once he drops down, Denham has a brief speech about it. And it ends with him saying, quote, "Kong, the eighth wonder of the world." You know, and we cut right to New York. So I'm going to pause there and then rejoin the 1976 film and cover the rest of the Skull Island scenes. So we get right into sort of the relationship between Kong and Dwan, and it's a little goofy. I mean, again, you know, unfortunately, all the shots of Kong in the 76 remake, just really fake, just a guy in a gorilla suit. And then this is sort of the start of their relationship where she goes from being terrified to finally being frustrated and angry, hits him in the nose, you know, and then we're into full-on comedy, where she's talking to Kong, "What sign are you? I'm an Aries," and all this kind of crap. And Kong does have some expressions that work. You know, earlier I mentioned that some of the masks that they used for this remake skull have different expressions. And we can tell that he's kind of taken with her. And then there's that really odd, this gets a little sexual here, which is weird. First of all, she gets kind of muddy, and then, you know, Kong puts her under the waterfall to wash her off, and then he blows her dry. And over it all is this goofy sort of love scene, the soundtrack cue that's just like, it's really weird. And I know from reading a little bit of the background, of how this was created. This is very deliberately they wanted some comedy in with her. And perhaps there was a way to do it that made it work, but it's kind of weird and goofy. I you know, if the film itself was less realistic, they mounted it and set it up very realistically and shot really well. In a weird way, it would have been better had there been a sense of, you know, Jackson's vibe before the comedy between the ape and the girl in this film, which is kind of weird. But anyway, it's very strange, and, you know, he's playing around with her. Just, you know, and we see that he's kind of aroused in a weird way, like he's looking at her like with this leering gaze, you know. So I don't know what the hell they were thinking. So we cut back and we find out they've run tests on the oil that they've found. It's not viable for any kind of extraction or use. It needs a couple of million years before it kind of matures into good petroleum. So it's good motivation in a sense, in that now the only thing that Wilson has left is Kong. Like, he's already, you know, it's good story chops. He's told the board that this is going to be the mother load of all mother loads. And of course, now he's wrong. And the only, now he figures if he can bring back Kong, you know, he can kind of maybe make up for it, and Kong will be this incredible advertisement for the company, right? So to me, it makes sense. So we get to the tree trunk scene, same as the first film, you know. Kong sort of camped out above them. They're all on the tree trunk. And again, this scene looks, I prefer the original to this one. It looks very fake. And they're all killed, just like the original film, except for Jeff Bridges' character, Prescott, and of course, Wilson, who survives. And we get a shot now of this Kong lives up on this mountain. And in this film, it's a twin pillar. So there's sort of two pillars. And it's going to come into play later in the film, which I think is very clever in changing the climax of the film to the new tallest buildings in Manhattan, which are unfortunately no longer with us. But they set it up here by showing us the island and showing the Kong looking off into the distance, seeing these two twin tower-like mountains that are his home. So that's a setup shot. And then there's more Kong and Dwan, and he's taking her clothes off. And, you know, at this moment, I feel like Kong is basically the movie producer. Like, you know, let's get her clothes off in that scene. So it's kind of just weird and creepy. And then there's a fight with the giant snake, which looks terrible. I mean, this was the decade where they kind of abandoned stop motion, and we hadn't had CGI yet or really good any other kind of special effects. So we did. There was a lot of, you know, like in some of the Jules Verne stuff, Journey to the Earth's Core, you know, filming small lizards and making them seem like large lizards by doing back screen stuff. And then people in suits, right? Godzilla suit, King Kong suit. And the snake looks really fake, you know, when they're fighting. It just looks like a completely fake thing. And there's nothing to it. They don't shoot it well enough where I'm really getting the sense of majesty and epicness, which I think in a monster movie of this kind, you know, you need to feel that sense of epic power from these creatures. And I do feel it in the original, but I do not feel it in this. And so this, you know, the snake fight's kind of boring. So very similar that the Jeff Bridges character gets Dwan away from Kong, and they jump into a river and they set a trap for Kong. They dig this pit. Kong comes back to the village, as in the first film, you know, goes crazy. Coming through the gate is great, as in the original film. I was wondering, maybe because it was the scale, amongst scale, like when he's shot somehow with smaller people or larger items where he's put into context, it looks a little bit better than if he's just, you know, himself in a gorilla suit with nothing around but trees to give him scale. So it looks a little bit better here. And of course, he falls into the chloroform pit and he's down. Now we do a little bit more before New York. There's a little sequence of Kong out at sea. They've had this huge oil tanker has come to take him, and he's deep inside one of the oil tanks looking up. And it's actually the first moment where we feel sad for Kong, and we see it in his face. And it was very affecting, actually. I was kind of surprised by it. You know, Wilson is over the moon about what's going to happen when they get back to New York. And so he's organizing this tour. He wants Dwan to be in it. And then in the midst of this, you know, rather successful, but for some weird, but for Kong, I think, remake, there's this amazing line in this movie. Prescott is the only one who's kind of bummed about Kong. You know, Dwan is sort of like, you know, if Jack goes along with the exploitation of Kong, she will, because she's like, you know, she feels that she got cheated out of her movie by the fact that the guy, you know, whose boat she was on died. So this is her chance. And she really wants to sign up with Wilson, but, you know, she sees that Prescott is torn. So Prescott has this great line, and Wilson's saying, you know, the people on the island are going to miss Kong the least. And he says, quote, actually, they'll miss him a lot. And Wilson says, like leprosy. And he's like, no, you're dead wrong. He was the terror, the mystery of their lives, and the magic. A year from now, that will be an island full of burnout drunks. When we took Kong, we kidnapped their god, end quote. And I thought, man, where the hell did that come from? You know, like, it's a great little moment. It struck me as like a very, very wise understanding of the role that God and or religion and or spirituality plays in life. You know, that is a mystery and magic in their lives, and that without that, they're just going to be these drunk villagers with nothing to worship and nothing to connect to. And, you know, there was kind of a symbiotic relationship between Kong and the villagers, and he provided a sense of meaning in their lives, even though he was terrible and they had to sacrifice part of their people to him. You know, the rational part of our brains is like, oh, you know, how evil that they have to give Kong, you know, people to kill however often they do. And that's terrible and barbaric, and it's a good thing that it's over. And it's like, well, yes and no. You know, that it's a very thorny sense of like when rationality becomes all you have, that you do, I don't know, you do lose something. It's possible that you do lose something in your life, a sense of the ineffable, and life maybe takes on a much more grimmer, a much more pedestrian thing where you just, I don't know. So I just think it's a great, in the middle, and this is why I love genre film. At one point, some part of the film will pop up and smack you in the face and do something great like this. And so I really love that. Just wanted to kind of highlight that in this film. So before we cut out, Duan's scarf blows down into the tank and Kong goes berserk. And he's smashing it, and they're going to have to flood the tank and kill him because he's going to destabilize the ship until Duan herself jumps down, which is kind of cool for her character, right? That she's brave enough to jump down into his arms again and calm him down. And then once he kind of relaxes, he actually lets her go, and she climbs back up. And so it's a nice moment between them. You know, the island was kind of creepy, but now that Kong is sort of more of the figure under threat or incapacitated, you know, more of her feeling for him is coming out, and it's getting a little complicated, and I kind of like that. And his facial expressions, again, in this type of scene are really great. You know, mixed in with the goofy stuff about her getting stripped and, you know, whatever. There's some real feeling going on here, which I was kind of thrown by. So we'll pause here and we'll switch over to Jackson's film. Again, we're into another action sequence. You know, the crew is out looking for Andarrow, and there's a dinosaur stampede, which, you know, right out of Jurassic Park, basically. It all looks incredibly fake and very CGI. You know, nothing really matters that much. And then we have an escalation where a pack of velociraptors join the fray, and they're eating some of the herbivores, and then they're chasing the human beings, and Denham's cameraman gets killed, which is the first of a couple of people in this film who get killed. And, you know, Denham rather cannily or callowly says, you know, we're going to finish the picture for that person, and someone else dies, and he's like, so-and-so would have wanted us to finish this picture. And in another movie with a different tone, I think it would have been an interesting thing. But in this movie, it just, you know, Jack Black also doesn't really deliver it in a way that makes me believe he believes it, you know? And then we cut to probably the best part of Jackson's Kong. It is not devoid of affecting scenes, you know? The scenes between Kong and Anne on Skull Island are unbelievably good. And so now we cut to their first one, and this is when we first get our first real reveal of Kong. We can really take him in as a full being next to her and his fur, and it looks very, very good. She tries to escape, and Kong blocks her, and he's very angry. And we see in this shot that he's very gorilla-like. He's got this big butt. He's on, you know, mostly on all fours. Very mean. He's got these fangs. Very realistic looking. And then there's a wonderful, startling scene where Anne does these dance moves where she moves very startling. She's still and then jumps and moves very quickly and then stops again. And it makes Kong laugh. And because of that, he starts to play back with her and knock her over, and she makes these moves. And when she stops doing what he wants her to do, he rages at her pretty convincingly, throwing rocks and smashing things. You know, he can't get his way. It's a great sequence. There's no dialogue. There's a wonderful change in tone and mood. And we see Kong show a range of emotions, not just anger. He's smitten with her. He's laughing. Then he's angry. And it's amazing. And then at one point, I guess because she doesn't continue to play with him, he's kind of feels spurned and bolts off into the jungle. But it's a wonderful, the art of motion pictures. You know, it's a wonderful moment of just visual magic where, you know, the relationship between them is, it begins, and it begins quite convincingly. For the first time in this film, there are two characters that are interacting in a way that I'm convinced that they're building a relationship. So, you know, we're over an hour into the scene, and it's between Kong and Anne, but it's great. Of course, we have yet another giant log scene. This scene is much more comic booky, and where not only the men getting twisted off the trees, but the tree takes forever to fall. Like, it's just this drawn-out sequence where the tree falls a little bit, and then it falls a little bit more, and then someone else does. And I mean, he just drags it out. But again, like the first film, only Denham and Prescott survive. And now we get to the Kong versus the T-Rex, which you'd think in a film like this would be spectacular because, you know, we have the Jurassic Park-level T-Rexes and Kong. But this is in the point of the film now, which really action sequence exhaustion is starting to set in. You know, we see the T-Rex come onto the scene. It eats a giant caterpillar. I think it was trying to eat her. And yet, even though it's still sated and full of food, it still chases her for whatever reason. She falls. It moves off and doesn't eat her. But then another T-Rex is right next to her. So there's like three T-Rexes. And they have this long, protracted battle where Kong is holding Anne. You know, in the first film, when he fights the T-Rex, she's in a tree. And so we get to focus on the ferocity of Kong versus the T-Rex. This is a very hijinky, it's more played for like an adventure-y for kind of laughs in a weird way. Kong is flipping Anne between hands as he's battling three T-Rexes. And to me, it's not very interesting because he can never really dominate. And, you know, to see Kong dominate and beat the crap out of these things is part of why you come to these movies. But it's done very much as like every second is going to be suspense. Or is he holding off the T-Rex here? And where is Anne okay there? And I just, it's very, very cartoony. It's way too long. And it's boring because it's just something about it that feels very uninteresting, especially with her being in the midst of it. And the soundtrack Q2 is not ominous and scary and majestic. It's like, well, what's gonna happen? Like, this is crazy. What an action sequence, you know. So, and of course they do the jaw-breaking of the last one, and by then you're just like, you know, for me personally, I'm like, who cares? So then, because you don't have enough action moments in this film, we get to the reveal of Denham's cameras now smashed, all the film is ruined. And they're in the midst of this sort of place where all these bugs start to come out. So now there's this battle between them and giant bugs that goes on for a while. And then the crew comes to rescue them and winds up killing a lot of the bugs. And there's a lot of guys who die and you're supposed to care because it's a little more serious in tone, but it doesn't really matter. So there's that scene. And then you have another wonderful wordless scene between Kong and Anne, which is a weird shift where they're up on a ledge, as in the first film, really enjoying a sunrise. And they allow it to play out. The two of them just sitting up there. She's relaxing. Kong's sitting there enjoying this wonderful sunrise. And she juggles for him and he loves it. Like, it's really wonderful. And then, of course, we cut back to the crew and we get the whole plan of trapping Kong with the chloroform. And, you know, then Jack finally catches up to her and Kong and grabs her. Instead of a pterodactyl in this film, he's set on by a clutch of giant bats. So as he's battling the bats, he gets away. Driscoll and Anne get away, jump into the river, you know, very similar to the first one. The capture of Kong is dragged out again. They get him with one shot with chloroform, but he sees Anne kind of going away, so he's revived, and it takes forever. You know, there is a pretty intense scene in the village where he's pretty much indiscriminately killing villagers. Pretty intense, eating them, smashing them, you know, all kinds of things, destroying everything, and it's really dragged out. And then he's finally harpooned several times, and then Denham finally throws a can of chloroform under his nose, and he's down. So a brief comparison of the Skull Island drama. To me, the original is something very special. The beautiful of the shots in black and white. The fights are the best. The 76 remake, unfortunately, Kong and whatever creatures he's battling mostly look fake. And he only has one fight against the snake, and it's not very interesting. Story-wise, both the original and the 76 remake are fine. You know, they progress fine without a lot of fat. There's not a lot of hijinks in it. The weird comic sexual angle of the 76 remake is kind of goofy and, to me, does not work very much. However, Jackson's film does have the most effective single sequences, and all the sequences between Kong and Anne are really beautiful and very touching, actually, more than both of the earlier films. I think this is the one thing, in my mind, that this film got so right was the relationship between Kong and Anne and how completely wordless it was and how beautiful it was because of that. So, totally nails it. But Jackson's film is an exhaustive in its action sequences. It's completely and utterly exhaustive. And you don't really care about any of the characters. No one's interesting. And every action sequence goes on way too long. And the stakes are just not, you know, because you don't really give a crap about the characters. To me, the stakes are not even there. So, man, I'm exhausted by Jackson's film. Okay, so let's do the last chunk of these films, which is the New York City sequences. We'll start with the original, the reveal of Kong to the audience. And, you know, we're in this theater. which we've cut right to from the island. And the reveal of Kong in this theater, he's shackled to this bar and very effective, you know, very effective looking with Denham standing in front of him. And the trick here is once the photographers come out to take pictures of him, he freaks out and breaks loose very quickly, crashes back out of the theater into the city, starts killing and killing people and tossing them aside, which is pretty intense, actually, for this film. Like, it's pretty brutal. There's a shot of a sleeping woman, and outside her window is Kong's face. And he sees a woman and grabs her. And she, when he realizes that she's not Anne, he drops her, which is pretty, you know, hardcore. Then in the coincidence of all coincidences, he's outside a window. Jack Driscoll and Anne are inside, and he, what luck, right? And he reaches in and knocks out Driscoll and takes Anne captive. And there's a brief moment where he knocks over an elevated train. They do some great photography here, actually, in the original, where the camera is at the point of view of the train heading towards Kong. And we see him sort of, destroy the tracks and the rails as we come right up on him. And it's a pretty intense sequence. And then Kong's face is at the window of the train. But a great action sequence with a really interesting camera work. Okay, and then we've got, of course, the penultimate moment, climbing the Empire State Building and the biplanes. There's a wonderful shot of Kong climbing this Empire State from a distance. And they do hold for a while, and he holds Anne. They sort of wait up at the top for a while, and then we have the battle. And what's great about this, and Jackson got a lot of this right as well, that the camera is put at the point of view if you were one of the biplane fighter pilots as they approach Kong on the Empire State Building. It's like, this is modern action movie camera work way before its time. It's unbelievable. It's some of the most startling photography in a film of this era that you're likely to see anywhere. You know, you really feel, even though this film was made in 1933, you know, go Google that last fight. Go look for it on YouTube, man. You know, there are moments when the planes are approaching Kong and flying by him when it's very affecting, you know, really, really impressive. It's not overly long, but it's long enough. He's able to take down one plane. And we do see, as he's getting tagged, he starts to bleed in the neck. Drops down to his knees. And then we have, of course, the moment with Anne where he picks her up again and she wants to be held to protect him and he puts her down. And then there's a wonderful final hit, which is very affecting. And we see from a long shot that he smashes and then he's down. And at that moment, Driscoll has made it up to grab Anne, so she's safe. And on the street, we have the classic, you know, Carl Denham walks by the body and, well, Denham, the airplanes got him. No, it wasn't the airplanes. It was Beauty that killed the Beast. Which, for all its goofiness, ends the theme of the film, right? Which is, you know, kind of what they were going for. So, very solid sequence. You know, solid story. They cut right to it. Not a lot of fat. Not a lot of nonsense. And the photography is fantastic. Now, the 76 film, we're starting with opening night of their, you know, Kong presentation. And Prescott quits, basically, you know, that he's not going to become part of it. And he tells Duan that he loves her, which there's no chemistry in this relationship whatsoever. So Duan is sort of painted here as sort of the shallow careerist. She refuses to leave him. And this time they hold it outdoors in a place that kind of mimics the island sacrifice altar. She's put in this sacrifice, you know, in these sort of shackles like she used to be. And then they wheel out this giant Petrox gas station pump. When it's pulled up, Kong is manacled and caged within. And, you know, I think to myself, boy, the metaphor in terms of like environmental rape, you know, inside of a gas tank is sort of a, you know, a caged animal, right? The metaphor, you can just kind of stack it. Pretty cool. Kong makes short work of the cage, obviously, is a mass exodus from this arena. Again, he still looks like a guy in an ape suit, so not great. And Wilson is killed, so the Denham character in this sequel is stomped on because he is truly a bad guy, I guess. And now Prescott is with Duan trying to get her out, and Kong completely destroys the arena. So we have New York completely mobilizing Duan and Jack on an elevated subway. Again, similar scene, Kong by the tracks, oncoming train. He picks up a car and actually throws it, but it all looks like a toy train set. The placement of the camera in the original was really much better and gave you an actual sense of scare, you know, where this one really all looks like a guy in a suit on a train set. So we get a sense in this film that he's able to smell Duan wherever she is. Like the original, he's picking up women that when they're not Duan, kind of tossing them away. So in this one, the arena where they unveiled Kong was not in New York. So Jack seems to think that once they get to Manhattan that, you know, Kong can't swim and they'll be safe. And of course, we see him walk through, I don't know, it's the East River or the Hudson, but, you know, submerge in the water and we kind of get a sense that he's on his way in. And we see Jack in Manhattan see the Twin Towers and have that moment of recognition where he realizes that it looks very much like Kong's home back on Skull Island. So we have that him and Duan take refuge in this restaurant, and then, you know, Kong comes out of the water and destroys a power station, which is kind of right out of a Godzilla movie, really, plunges in the city in darkness, and Jack then convinces the mayor and the military he knows where Kong is going. He asks them for a promise to capture and not kill. So while he's calling the mayor, Kong reaches into the restaurant, grabs Duan, and off he goes to the Twin Towers. So the end game here, there's a bit of comedy before he gets to the Twin Towers. Kong walks by a church, and a priest comes out and sees Kong, and he makes the sign of the cross and runs back inside. Ha ha. Climbs the World Trade Center and has a little bit of a moment with the full moon kind of beating his chest. Jack kind of gets all the way up to the top to kind of witness his final battle. So the military send up this flamethrower team against orders, you know, basically because they're going to kill him. And they start to torch Kong, but, you know, Kong's able to jump from one tower to the other. I always thought this was interesting that when you see the artwork for this film, Kong was standing one foot on each tower, which is probably how big he's going to be in the Kong Skull Island film. Not that big in the actual film. And in retaliation, Kong throws a gas tank at the flamethrower team, and it blows up, you know, and Prescott's cheering. So, Kong won, military zero at this point. And now we have the military helicopters instead of biplanes, because we're in, you know, present day, or present day 1976. And they're waiting for, you know, Kong to put Duan down. Jack sees the Gatling guns, and he realizes what's going on. And there's the protest between them. Again, very sad moment when you realize when he puts her down that it's kind of curtains for him. There's a lot of blood. You know, the helicopters make pretty much short work of him. He gets one of them, but they pretty much take him down. It's very bloody, and it is affecting in its way, you know, because there are certain times when this big monster such as Kong is under threat, when you kind of immediately feel like, hey, you know. And of course, you know that there's a relationship between him and Duan, so it kind of works in that way. He takes a second chopper down, but he's been damaged too badly, so he falls down on top of the Trade Center next to Duan, and then he slowly rolls off. And then we cut down to the street, and we hear the heartbeat only, and then it slows and it stops. And then later, we see Duan amidst all of the, you know, photographers, and Prescott arrives, and she can't get to him because of all the photographers, and she kind of gives up trying to get to him, which I thought was a nice little moment at the end of, like, you know, her character is like she's always going to be prey to wanting to be super famous and to go after stardom. And that, you know, it's not a happy ending between her and Prescott, that she's going to head into the light and that he's going to kind of walk away from it, you know. So anyway, that ends the sequel. So let's finish up with Jackson's Kong. Again, we cut to New York City and the Eighth Wonder of the World. Now the film veers off, it kind of does more of what it's been doing, into this strange mix of madcap and tragic that, again, never really works for me. He looks very tragic on stage. When they finally reveal him, oh, it's very hard to watch. He's kind of slumped down, defeated. And then they bring this woman in front of him and he rouses, but it's not Anne. And in this film, she had turned Denham down and she works back in a kind of a vaudeville review where she started. And I think Kong, not seeing Anne there, kind of lost it. And then the photographers come, and between the woman not being Anne and the flashbulbs, he kind of loses it and breaks out. Grabs the girl, tosses her away, very brutal, and tears up the theater and makes his way out into Times Square. So there's a big sequence in Times Square where he's tossing cars around, and he's seeing women who remind him of Anne, who have blonde hair, picking them up and throwing them away. Tons of action. There's a sequence where he sees Jack, and Jack gets into a cab. So there's this long chase. It reminded me of the Godzilla sequence in New York where Godzilla is chasing our heroes in a cab near the end of the film. And it's very similar. You know, there's this just long hijinksy chase between Kong and Jack in a cab, and because he's trying to draw him off. And it just goes on forever. But Anne sees eventually that he's about to kill Jack, and she saves him by showing up. Then it's bizarre because we get a scene between them in Central Park. In the midst of all this mayhem and military, they go kind of ice skating on a frozen Central Park lake, which is beautiful. They're sliding around and laughing and having fun. And I get it, but it doesn't belong here. And the Mekong is in, you know, just escaped from this strange place. And I don't know. You can argue it either way, I guess. But again, it's between this scene and the other scenes on the island with Anne, and the scene at the Empire State Building to come with him and Anne are the best parts of the movie. So I don't mind when they come on the screen, but it's just very jarring in how they're kind of shoehorned in sometimes. So, and then it ends quickly as the military finally attacks. So This chase scene occurs on rooftops, and he finally gets to the Empire State Building, and we get our last beautiful scene where they really milk it, and you're up there with Kong and Anne, and it's wordless and a beautiful scene. And it's, you know, I feel in this scene the sense of tragedy. What I love, what Jackson is able to do with this scene is you really get the sense of being up high. You know, even when I'm watching this film, there was something about watching the scene that made me really kind of like, oh shit, we're way up. I don't know how he did it. I mean, he must have figured out a way to leave a lot of the bottom of the city in the frame a lot of the time, because I always get a sense of how high we are. And it makes this battle seem that much more for stakes. I mean, obviously it's for stakes for Kong, but there's something about it that really is tense and good, and it doesn't go on for too long, which is amazing. I think he took a page from the Marianne Cooper film, and that we get a point of view camera behind the biplanes, whereas in the first film, it was in the front of the planes. Here, he puts it behind the plane, so we see the plane, but we also see Kong, and we get this wonderful sense of motion as they're attacking him, as we're kind of riding shotgun. It's really great. The thing I don't like is that there's a lot of now human hijinks where Anne's hanging off a ladder, Kong has to save her during this battle, and they really drag it out again with her, and you know, first she's on the ladder, then she's okay, then she's not okay. So Kong has to continually save her and fight the planes. I just don't think you need it. And then Jack finally arrives up top to help her, and it's a beautifully tragic ending. The Kong character in this film is just so tragic when he's in situations that it calls for that really pulls your heartstrings. So, you know, same thing. He's taken out and down he goes. And it's the same Beauty and the Beast line, but boy, does it fall flat. You know, just to compare briefly the last three, I think the original film probably does the best in terms of a straight storytelling and really startling photography for its time. The remake is kind of played in a weird way, and Kong mostly is a guy in a big gorilla suit, so I never get this majesty that I get even with the first film. And the battle at the top of the World Trade Center is not filmed in a way that's very exciting. You know, Kong just kind of gets torn up, and some of it looks okay at times. Like, you know, it's all done with models, right? So it does have a sense of realism, but I don't know. There's something about it that doesn't really move me. And in Jackson's, unfortunately, it's stuffed full of a bunch of crap. More action scenes and longer action scenes that we don't need. But there's something about the final battle on the Empire State Building, which is really fantastic. You know, unfortunately, it's a little bit overstuffed and a little bit dragged out. But man, it's shot really well. And you really do feel it when Kong dies, which I think is what you need. You know, just to kind of play around with the characters here, and compare them a little bit. The Carl Denham character in the first film, Robert Armstrong, I just really like. Again, he's in that very stagey kind of acting as is done back then, but he's a very charismatic actor and I really liked him. And, you know, we had the Beauty and the Beast theme with him the entire time. I believed in him as a character, kind of what he wanted and what he was prepared to do for it. The Wilson character was fine. I don't think Alan Arkin was like the best choice, right? But he was okay. Like, he was believable in why he was out there and what he was doing. But there wasn't anything special about his performance or his character. And the Jack Black Denham is just kind of a throwaway, because to me, Jack Black didn't belong in this movie. He belonged in like a comedy King Kong, and I never really bought him for a second in the serious lines, or even when there was supposed to be funny stuff going on. I just felt like he was a mask and he was mugging most of the time. That he never really inhabited the role. He was just kind of really, really fake for me. So I have to go with the original Denham, I think, is my favorite character. In terms of the female lead, we have the two Ann Darrows and Dwan. I'm torn between Faye Ray and Naomi Watts. I think Jessica Lange was fine, but they didn't really give her much to do in the film, so there's really no place for her to be anything. I mean, the best performance probably has to go to Naomi Watts during the scenes with Kong. She was kind of given nothing else to do outside of those scenes, but in the scenes with Kong, they were really effective. I thought she did a wonderful job of, you know, acting without words in a way. But I really love Faye Ray. There's something very winning about Faye Ray. Not given much to do in a sense, but I don't know. There's something ineffable about her in that movie that I really like. I can't quite put my finger on it. You know, and just to briefly sum up, I think that if you put Jackson's relationship with the ape in the first movie, you have the movie that, you know, I would like to see. And the overall tone, I think I like the storytelling and the awe and majesty of the monster battles of the first one. I like the realism and the setup of the second one. And I really like the relationship between Anne and Kong in the third one, you know. So that's kind of like I'm cherry picking from each to the other. And the original has a definite flair, and it, because it doesn't do too much else other than tell a story in a very straightforward, purposeful way, to me, it never gets very boring. It is what it is for its time, but it doesn't get very boring. The 76 film can go on a bit long. And, you know, when you're on Skull Island, the battles are, you know, increasingly fake looking, and so is Kong, that you get a little bored. And Jackson's film is interminably boring. I mean, it took me so many tries to get through it. Just for this podcast, I had to just give myself a rest, because every action sequence in the movie could have been, you know, the third act finale action sequence of any other movie, right? So anyway, that's kind of my take on the three Kongs. I'm very excited to see Kong Skull Island, which is coming up. The trailers look amazing. I think it takes place in the 70s. It's kind of a prequel to the Godzilla films, because they're going to put Kong in the Godzilla universe and ultimately have a Godzilla versus Kong film in a couple of years from now. So looking very much forward to that. That's all I've got to say about Kong Original versus Remix. I'll see you next time.